This is Julian Pleasants, and I am in Gainesville, Florida. It is May 21st, 2007, and I'm with Mr. Stephen Lawrence, Tuskegee Airman. When and where were you born, Mr. Lawrence?
Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
What year?
As October 14th, 1921.
1921. And what was your early life like in Philadelphia? What did your parents do? What kind of school did you have?
Well, being raised in Philadelphia, which is a large city, I went to Ben Franklin High School. You know, my father was a laborer at the Lamprecht Mining Company. My mother was a housewife.
That has a reputation of being a good school, the Ben Franklin School.
Right.
Yeah. Then at what point did you get involved with the Tuskegee?
I was a welder in the at the shipyard in Chester, Pennsylvania. So I was deferred two or three times. And my friends went into the military, but when they came home on a furlough, they had servitude jobs. They were cutting grass, and BOQ, and other little jobs. And so I never wanted to enlist in the military. So I could have enlisted, although I was deferred. However, I was drafted in 1943, February 22nd, 1943. I was drafted. I took an AGCT test. And I appeared to have made high marks. And they said, well, you qualify for any branch of service you want to get into. I said, well, give me a couple of minutes and try to figure out. So I figured my friends had been in, and all of them had been in the other branches except the Air Force. So I said, I want to go to the old Army Air Corps. And they said, okay, Mr. Lawrenceville. And they sent me home for a week or two, and I went back into the Air Force.
Okay, and then where did you go? Where did they send you for training?
Well, they didn't know what to do with me. So they sent me to Kansas.
Oh, okay.
And then I went to Pocatello, Idaho. And then they said, well, give me another test. And they said, would you like to go to airplane mechanic school? I said, yes. They gave me another test, and they sent me to Shepherd Field, Texas. And I was assigned to a 320th Technical School Squadron. And they call that the Shepherd Field Army, Shepherd Field Technical School, anyhow, Wichita Falls, Texas.
And how many would have been in your group going through the training?
At that time, in my class, there were probably about 150.
And what year would this be at this point?
It is 1943.
Okay, and what was the Army like during this time? Obviously still segregated.
It was very segregated, and at that time we had, at Shepherd Field we had white instructors, and they gave us speed courses. But I'm a slow learner, and we had some fellows who were in the class, they were very apt. We were smart enough to get back into our classes, and the questions or things we had we didn't quite get, we went over in the class in our barracks, and we were prepared to meet the challenge when we got back in the classroom. That way we survived.
Was there blatant discrimination against you by the white officers?
Not yet, because before I had got to Shepherd Field, we had been assigned to service battalions, so that was segregated. So you knew what to expect then.
Yeah.
But when I went back to Shepherd, when I went to Shepherd Field, there was a little segregation there, but we didn't go to town. I think they let us go to town maybe twice for the whole 8 months that we were there. So. So naturally, we didn't have too much outside contact with the other groups. Being from Philadelphia, going into going through this type of situation was kind of hard to.
It's a big, big change for you, wasn't it? Yeah.
Kind of hard.
And were, did you expect that, though, when you went out there? Did you know when you were going to be in the South or in Texas that it was going to be more difficult than it would have been in Philadelphia?
Now, not really. Of course, in Philadelphia, we still, there's still a little segregation in Philadelphia, sure, as well, but not as, as blatant as it was in Alabama and in Texas, other places. So I expected a little bit because some of the other fellows that we were from the South. So we knew how to live with the people we had to live with.
Right, yeah. How to adapt to that situation.
That's it.
Well, that must have been difficult because you have 8 months. You really don't have much social outlet at all. Mm-hmm. What did you spend your time doing?
Well, we studied. We shot pool in a day room. I wasn't a Christian then. And we drank beer. We played cards. And that's about it.
Yeah, a lot of beer, I expect. Yeah. Now, what is the situation as they're training you? Are you being trained specifically for any type of plane?
No, yes. We were trained for the B-25.
Okay.
The B-25, the old Billy Mitchell. And you know, we were trained for the B-25 from the front to the tail. Trained the whole outfit. The only thing I couldn't do was fly. I knew it. I knew how it operated, and they even let us. Before we graduated, we would take a little test run down the taxi strip. That's about it. You knew how to, and taught us how to feather the props and all this other kind of thing. And we learned a lot. A lot of things I still remember.
It's good. I heard from the pilots I've talked with, the B-25 was a hard plane to fly.
Is that right?
That's what I've heard. Mm-hmm. I don't know particularly why, but mm-hmm. They said it was a lot harder to fly than the B-17 or the B-29.
Oh, okay.
Now, when you did all this training, you did the electrical, you did everything, right? You knew how to repair anything on that plane.
See, my job was not to repair it.
Okay.
I'm a crew chief.
Oh, okay.
I inspect the plane. If the hydraulic system goes out, I call the hydraulic department. They repair it.
Okay.
If I need tires, I go to the tire shop. What if I needed, if the air went out or the gas line was leaking or oil leaks or something like that, I got that department, they repaired it. My responsibility is to see if it was repaired right.
Right.
I inspected.
And to find what was wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm the crew chief and I'm supposed to find out what's wrong and have it repaired.
Okay, now you graduated after 8 months.
Right.
And were they conscientious in training you? I mean, it would seem to me that they would want you to be effective and efficient in your job. So were the white instructors supportive? Did they want you to succeed?
Not really. It appears that they was a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. They wanted a job. They were non. They were, well, all of us were privates, and they were non-commissioned officers. So they just took us to the thing, you know, as if this is the job for me, that's all. You get it or you don't get it, with no proof to see whether you acquired anything or not.
So they didn't help you if you needed help?
No.
They just left it up to you?
Left it up to us.
Well, I would imagine there was a lot of cooperation among all the students, Jack.
You know, it's funny, before I get to that one, I'll carry on. It's funny, being raised in Philadelphia and going into the South like that, into the military like that. Up North, we always felt that the Southern people were a little stupid. And because they ate greens, and we ate potatoes and stuff like that, and their language structure, their culture was different than ours. And when I got into the military and went to school, who would I find but the Southern fellows who had all the education? And I found out later because down here, down south, they had A&Ts, A&M schools, and they were allowed to go to school, and they had Tuskegee Institute, and I think the only one I knew that had them in Philadelphia was Lincoln, mm-hmm. outside of Philadelphia. But other than that, in Howard, and Howard University, that's about all. So when we did get in the military and we started to be competitive, so to speak, we found the Southern fellows from down home here They had more than a ball than we did.
And would a fair percentage of them already have been to college?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. They were more educated than we were because they had, I don't know how many degrees they had, but these fellas started to squirt off the Prairie View in Texas, and they started talking about the other colleges that I hadn't heard of.
Grambling?
They had attended.
Grambling?
Yeah, Grambling, right,
Bethune-Cookman, a lot of schools.
Oh, yeah, but I didn't hear too much about Bethune-Cookman.
Yeah.
I didn't hear too much about...
It was still a small school.
Yeah, I didn't hear about that. But I did hear about Prairie View out there, and I heard about the Tuskegee and Howard. That's about all I heard.
And then, at the end of this time, you're going to get a rating as a crew chief. What do they give you once you graduate? You get a diploma,
well,
you get a rating?
We got a little diploma.
Yeah.
And I got a MOS, that's a military serial
occupational specialty.
Yeah. I got my MOS was 747 as an airplane mechanic.
Okay.
But then attached to that was in parentheses a crew chief.
Good.
That was it.
So at that point, where do you go once you graduate?
After I graduated, they sent me back to Tuskegee. Sent me to Tuskegee. I hadn't been to Tuskegee yet. Sent a whole group of us. They had a C-46 and they flew us into Tuskegee. And we had a black pilot. That was funny to me. I had never seen a black pilot. I have all this education all in school and I had never seen a black pilot. This guy flew a C-46 into Shepherd Field, picked us up, flew us back to Tuskegee, and we signed our barracks. And then I was assigned first to a transit aircraft. A transit aircraft is where you meet all the planes that come in. I hadn't been assigned a plane yet. Transit aircraft, and then we had, it's funny that when I went to transit aircraft, I met a whole lot of fellas there that I did. I think Marshall, fellow named Marshall, was Lieutenant Marshall, he was in charge charge of our transit aircraft. Then we had, when I got to Tuskegee now, Clarence Jones was the provost marshal, he's black. And then I got to Hodges was the acting first sergeant. Thomas Agnew was in the office. He was in the office too. Earl Smith was in charge of radio repair. And then other fellows, Herman Brandon was the chaplain assistant. And then the...
And all of these are African-American?
Oh, yeah, all of them, yeah. And then Price D. Rice also was assistant in the transit aircraft. When I got there, I was signed with a fellow named Eugene Giles, Joe Turner, a fellow named Kirkendall. Now, Kirkendall was smart. He was from Texas. He was the one that had all of Kirkendall. A guy named Bowser. Deloach was our barber. Then a fellow named Pettiford, Meneer, Covington, Eugene Bowser, and you never heard of Slim Gaylor. You ever heard of Slim? No, Slim Gaylor was a guitar player. He was in our group. Then a fellow named Eddie Breaker. Deloach was our barber. These were some of the people that I had met when I got to Tuskegee.
Now, describe to me, this is after the airfield has been built, right?
Oh, yes. It's
so
an operation.
That's all done, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So describe to me, when you got there, describe to me Tuskegee Airfield. What was it like? How big was it? How many planes, pilots, do you remember in general?
Well, the airfield, to me, it was large, but actually when you look around these fields, that's just small.
Yeah.
And it had... I think I only saw two runways, north, south, east, and west. That's all I saw. A couple of aprons taxi back to the tower. But it's a small airfield. We had a black, all the fellows on the field were black. Mm-hmm. The fellow that gives the oil, the guy in the tower, control tower, he's black. The fellow in the emergency, in case of a fire or something like that, he was black.
Now, you were, at this point, in enlisted quarters.
Oh, yes.
What were they like?
Well, they were nice. The barracks were nice. And we lived according to military regulations. Mm-hmm. And we receive the same pay that the Air Force, but we're still treated as an experiment.
Yeah.
We're still treated as an experiment because we could hear in the background that you felt not gonna last long. And I tell you something funny in here?
Yeah.
Okay. It was funny, I was in transit aircraft, they called me and said, Steve Lawrence, we have 12 AT-6s coming in, and we want you to park them on the apron AFP or whatever it was.
And these are the trainers?
These are trainers coming in. These are AT-6 advanced trainers, mm-hmm. and they're coming from Maxwell Field. See, Maxwell Field where they train white pilots. Tuskegee were trained black pilots. So when these, so when they said they'll be in at 0300, whatever time it was, they'll be in, and when they come in, bring them up to the day room, and we're going to brief them. I said, okay. So I got on my Follow Me Jeep, have a Jeep would follow me, and I went cruising down, and when the first guy came in, the guy, one of the fellas parked him, next fellow parked him. And but they didn't get out of the plane till all of them were set. And listen. When they all set, then they all got out of the planes and they dismounted and they came out and they saw all these black fellas and they're scared of the death.
they didn't know where they were going. Huh?
They looked, because we had the same uniform. We had fatigues, you know.
Oh, sure.
Two-piece fatigues. And they saw we. But they had jumpsuits. They were pilots. Sure. I mean, student pilots, cadets. And when they saw us, they jumped out. And I raised my hand like this. And I raised my hand, and that followed me. Then I took them up to the day room. But I never saw a fellow look so funny on my leg. They looked at one another. Well, I thought they landed in the wrong place.
Now they know what it's like being on the other side.
No, I'm not.
When you're only one of a certain color in the middle of a bunch of other people,
oh, boy.
It's a little disconcerting when
right.
you first get there.
Yeah, but there were 12 of them. I agree, 12 of them with about six of us.
Yeah.
They parked them, you know.
Well, now, in your quarters and the food and all of that, were they
good,
up to standard?
All good. Oh, yeah. As far as the mess hall and all that, that was all good. We didn't have to cut our grass. The service unit cut our grass, so we didn't have to do any service work. They did all of that.
And this is by the time you get there, by the time you're at Tuskegee, it's the end of 43, the beginning of 44.
Right. No, yeah, it's about the beginning of 44.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And once you get there, or as the new classes come in for pilot training, mm-hmm. are the instructors white or black?
The instructors were in there. The instructors and the trained cadets,
yeah.
they were white.
All white.
All white, right. Mm-hmm. They had them, what's it called, that thing they sit in, simulated.
Oh, flight. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, anyhow, they were white. And the classroom and all the teachers, even the PT instructors were white.
But everybody else was black.
Right. All of them, yes.
A link trainer.
Link trainer, that's it. Were you a pilot?
No. I just done a little reading. That helps. Let me ask you about the relationship between all of you and the people who were the pilot trainers.
Mm-hmm.
Did you interact much? Did
No.
you get along?
No. We didn't have anything to do with the instructors. The only thing we did was work with the cadets on the field. That's all. We didn't have anything to do with the instructors.
Now, when you were there, was the commander Kimball?
No.
Parrish.
Parrish.
Yeah.
Yes, he was a fine man.
Okay, you liked him?
Oh, yeah.
Was he fair?
Fair.
He must have been better than Kimball then, because in the beginning, I think people saw him as not being very helpful.
Colonel Parrish, well, I think Lena Horne came to visit us, and Joe Lewis came to visit us, and he was right out there with them. And I think Mahalia Jackson, or what's the other woman? Ethel Waters came.
Ethel Waters.
Yes.
Well, of course, the big star would have
been, star, yeah.
would have been the Horn, right?
Right.
I know she got a big crowd, didn't she?
Oh yeah, well, you know, everyone knew everybody. Mm-hmm. So, and Parrish was right there along with him. And we had a warm feeling. He treated us, and he associated with us, not as equal, but as his subordinates, but yet and still we had something in common.
Yeah,
so that's the type of attitude we had.
You're professionals in the Air Force,
right.
So you know you were in the South and you were going to be discriminated mm-hmm. against.
But he didn't treat us that way.
Well, that's good because apparently the first commander did.
Oh yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah. Now, give me an idea of what Lena Horne would do when she come. Did she give a concert?
She sang. She gave a concert. Everybody who came gave a concert. Even Joe Lewis got up there and bopped a little bit. You know, it's funny. You know. They had one of the fellows.
You didn't want to get in the ring with him.
No. Nobody else did. One fellow did get in the ring with him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just sparring, you know. But it was very interesting for him to show off a little bit. You know, he wasn't very well educated.
No, he was not. No.
Talk real flat.
But Lena Horne was.
Oh man.
Everybody liked her.
Oh yeah. Well, they liked them all. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was any discrimination among those who visit us, mm-hmm. because we treated them all with respect.
Now, was that helpful to you? I mean, it sort of boost your spirits a little bit?
Oh, a whole lot. I think it was a morale builder. Mm-hmm. But you were still in the military in the South.
That didn't change. Well, then, are you aware of the story about Eleanor Roosevelt coming to Tuskegee?
Oh, yeah, I heard about that, yeah.
What was the general reaction to that? The story I've heard is that they said, well, blacks can't fly.
Right.
She said, I don't believe that. And somebody took her up mm-hmm. and brought her back down, and she says, they can fly. Mm-hmm. And at that point, she called her husband and said, we need to get involved with training black pilots.
Well, see, when I think, like you say, that blacks, it was to us, it was a challenge because we were told that we don't have sense enough to fly. We didn't have the ability to fly. We had physically and mentally and everything else, we were behind reaching a goal as a pilot. Therefore, we were not given the privilege of being pilots in the Air Force. But We felt that the challenge had to be beaten. We had to prove something because give us a chance, you know. So when Eleanor Roosevelt came down that day, I understand. I saw the film. You see the film? You saw the film they said?
No, I haven't seen the film. No, I haven't seen it.
They got a little skit,
yeah.
Video. And when she came down, there's a lot of controversy. People didn't want black folk to end there. Segregated. Mm-hmm. They said, no, they would be equal. It's like integrated schools. Mm-hmm. They didn't want the schools integrated because there's going to be a whole lot of cross-the-board equality.
Yeah.
And they didn't want that. But said, our points were, we learned that, oh, give us a chance and we prove we can do something. I don't want to marry your daughter. No, I don't want to marry your daughter. What I want to do is earn a living for my family.
Well, I read somewhere in the beginning that when it was just being built, it was pretty bad. They were just in tents,
mm-hmm.
but that the white officers had their own commissary, had their own dining room, and in fact, the waitresses were black women. Mm-hmm. Do you know about that? Mm-hmm. Was that true? That was before your time.
Before my time, right.
Well, now, when you were there, was there an enlisted man's club?
Yeah.
Was that segregated?
I don't know anything about it. Enlisted man. We didn't have an enlisted
didn't have
man.
One, no.
No, didn't have one.
Okay.
We didn't have an officers club.
Do you have a commissary?
Well, I don't know.
Like a PX?
Yeah, PX. That was it.
That was it. That segregated?
No.
That wasn't segregated.
Not on the base.
Yeah.
Not on our base, it wasn't segregated.
Now, one thing I'm not really clear about, what was the relationship between the Tuskegee Airfield and the Tuskegee Institute?
Oh, the relation was fine. I went over there several times. But there was a little separation there because the people over at the over on the campus when we felt as though they were more intelligent than we were. Mm-hmm. So it was not too much. No, we didn't have that kind of fellowship.
Yeah, so you didn't hang out at the Institute very much?
I went over to Carver's lab, and I went over to the campus two or three times, but we didn't feel wanted over there.
Okay.
No.
Now, there's a well-known sheriff, I don't know if he was still there or not, named Pat Evans, who was a pretty racist sheriff, and periodically he would grab a few trainees and lock them up for obviously not very reasonable things that they had done. He just to be mean-spirited about it. Did you find any of that at all?
Yeah, if we prided in our dress, and if we were caught off base with the double worsted clothes, they wore khakis, you know, GI issued khakis, but we bought our own clothes, double worsted. They were beautiful clothes, man. Same as the officers wore, but we have
different stripes.
We had stripes. We didn't have bars. Anyhow, if they called us in town, they would lock us up.
Just for wearing those uniforms?
Right.
Because you were trying to emulate the white uniforms?
I don't know what they said. They said we were out of uniform, period. I don't know who they tried. We were proud. We had our wings. See, if you went up 4 hours a month, you got a half of your base, plus your base pay. Mm-hmm. See, if you got, I think I was getting $160 a month. That was clothes and all, you know, anyway, and food and all. But
you know who Charles Dryden is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He's what he said when he got there. He said he was scared as hell of the South. He had read about lynching. Mm-hmm. I had a healthy respect for the cruelty of the crackers down there. Mm-hmm. I mean, so he was, again, not used to that, but he got attuned to it pretty quickly.
He was in New York, I think.
Yeah, he was in New York, and he didn't want to get in a situation where, you know, he could get killed or badly beaten. Now, did you all have MPs or anybody who sort of policed?
Yeah, the MPs, the one who locked us up.
They were the ones?
They were the ones locking us up.
Were they white?
Yes.
They were all white?
All white. And if they called us, well, we used to go to Montgomery from Tuskegee, we'd go into Montgomery for the weekend pass, something like that. And if they catch you off the, if you went around, if they caught you at a certain time at night, in the evening, they'd lock you up. And you stayed in jail, and they had to come from Tuskegee to pick you up and bring you back. And when that happened, that made the folk at Tuskegee mad, you know, because they had to drive all the way over there to, I think, about 23 miles from Tuskegee over to Montgomery to pick you up for out of jail. I got busted a couple of times.
Well, we don't talk about that.
That's part of life, though.
Well, did you have someone who represented the African Americans to the white officers, or who could plead your case, or who could intercede in your behalf? Were there any black officers at all?
No. Yeah, we had black officers. As far as the administration is concerned, I don't think they had it. I didn't see any administrative. But we had black officers, Clarence Jones. He was a provost marshal. He was a provost marshal.
He could intercede in your behalf?
If he has, he could, but they wouldn't give him that privilege.
Yeah, okay.
That's no law protecting him either. And then we had Lieutenant Marshall. We had Lieutenant Price D. Rice. They were officers, but they were these two fellows were in charge of transit aircraft, and he was a provost marshal. Then we had the chaplain on there. He was a captain at first. He made major. He's a Baptist cat. I forget his name. I can't think of his name. But he was a pretty good preacher, too.
Would the white enlisted men, were there many of those?
I didn't hardly see many of them. They went to the classroom. You see, I was out on the field, out on the field, and the classrooms was like over here where the public is.
Yeah.
See, so I had that much interest, reaction with them.
Would white enlisted men salute black officers?
I don't know. I don't know.
Did you see any that you thought you should? You say you salute the white officers.
Oh, yeah, I salute them all.
Yeah.
But I didn't see that many.
Okay.
No. Because we didn't have that many. We had those three, those two or three officers on the post, but I didn't see any reaction.
Did you have a lot of interaction with the pilots, the trainees?
Oh yeah, they had to fly my plane after I was assigned a crew chief. Right. I was a crew chief on a BT-13. That's a basic trainer.
Yeah.
First, then I had an AT-6. Next. And last, I had a C-47 for a while, P-47 for a while. It was a big, ugly plane, too.
Yeah, they had the Stearmans, too. Did you have any Stearmans there?
No.
Well, it was another training plane. It was a PT-17?
Oh, yeah. You know what? The PT-17 was Second World War, First World War plane.
Yeah, I know it was.
and we used to have to go over to, they were stationed at Moulton Field.
Mm-hmm.
Moulton Field, where they stored those the old planes.
And that was an open cockpit, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one was PT-17 was a biplane.
Yeah.
And PT-23 was a single. I think it was a single PT-23.
Then they had this thing called the Vultee Vibrator. Did you have one of those?
No.
BT, which was a closed cockpit. So most of what you use would be the AT-6.
AT-6 and BT-13. That's the only ones I worked with.
Okay. And what was what were those planes like, particularly the trainer? I mean, obviously didn't have a lot of speed.
It was a nice plane. You learn how to take care of it. And every 3 months you had to take it to Compass Roads. I don't know if you know what a Compass Roads is. Mm-hmm. Compass Roads, you know what it is?
No.
That's a circle. And you have northeast, true north,
oh,
east,
yeah,
and that. Then you had to sit the plane there and set your compass every 3 months.
Yeah, to reset the compass.
Reset the compass. Yeah. But that's the only time I taxi it down the field, set it if it needs set.
Were you aware of the skill of the pilots and which ones got wings and which ones didn't?
No, I didn't get that close to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny. Sometimes we call them gadgets. when a gadget came out pretty smart, you know, sergeant, I'm assigned to TU-2017 might be my plane. You know, going up and I'll be going approximately 35 minutes, you know.
A little on the arrogant side.
Yeah, oh yeah, very arrogant. Well, these kids were college graduates, though.
Most of them were.
Oh, man, those kids were smart.
Oh, yeah.
And they looked at me and my grease marks, you know, so he looked at me like I'm nothing. So I said, when he come up there with that, I'll get my Form 41B. That's the inspector's thing. 1.1 there. I said, you know what? This plane got a leak under the left, you know. No, it can't fly this plane. Huh? No, you can't fly it. See, I got a red line right there. See, not sure.
You wouldn't know what that was.
Well, he had to take my word for it. I ain't going to let him go. Because I got to sign his paper before he can get off the ground.
Well, if he had good sense, he'd want to make sure it was working right.
Oh, yeah. So I said, it didn't pass inspection, and I have to ground it until I get it repaired. Well, how long did that take? I said, well, I checked with the hydraulics, and they said I wouldn't be able to get to it till tomorrow. Look real serious, you know. Wouldn't be able to get to tomorrow. Maybe you can try so-and-so to the guy down there. He sees what happened down there, my buddy down there. So I said, maybe check him out. So he goes, runs back to the briefing room and tell the officer what's going on down there. They sent him down to my buddy to the same thing. He don't fly that day.
Well, that taught him a lesson, didn't it?
Oh, yeah, no, arrogance, man.
You know, well, I would think they'd learn pretty quick.
Oh, yeah, they
learned. You know, some of these people, like Benjamin O. Davis, ended up being a major general.
Oh, yeah, well, he was a four-star general.
Four-star general, yeah. And some of the other people who came out of there were rather well known.
Chappie James was
Chappie James.
In fact, they have a chapter named after him, Chappie James. In fact, I saw Chappie James several times. He was first lieutenant.
So he was there when you were there. Oh, he's a big, huge guy.
Man, he's a big, I don't see I can get an AT-6. He's a big joker, but he's very jovial.
I heard he was, had a real command presence, you know, really. People kind of looked up to him.
Why not?
He was a role model. Yeah, I mean, not just because he was big, but I mean, because he was intelligent and capable.
He, we get down a little further, I guess. But anyhow, you know, after they deactivated, I might be going ahead of my story, but can I bring this in?
Sure.
We're, after they deactivated the 332nd and the 99th, this was at the end of the war, that they sent us to Godman Field, Kentucky. Godman Field, Kentucky was across the street from Fort Knox. Right across the street, a railroad separator, and a tar paper barracks. The CCC camp had it first. That's where we stayed. And Chappie James and some other fellows went through an arch. They had a bridge over the river. I think a river that separated Indiana from Kentucky. And they had a bridge, like, you know, and Chappie James all flew right through that thing. I think Chappie got busted.
I would hope so.
He did, he got busted. And a couple of guys got busted for buzzing the feet, buzzing the people.
Well, they love to do that.
Yeah.
I think Dryden got caught for that, didn't he? Well, you know, pilots are a different breed of people, aren't they?
Yeah.
In order to be a good pilot, you have to be pretty confident, don't you think?
You have to be. And, you know, when I first... went up, the second or third time I went up to earn my 4 hours per month, it gives you a different feeling. You know,
well, yeah,
you're way up here, up above the clouds, you look down and you see the farm, the squares and all. And when you go up there, you're all together, a different personality. You come down, you thought the way you had been, you know.
Yeah.
It makes you a different person.
It does. And so you would fly what? The AT-6?
Well, I arrive at AT-6, or if another guy is going somewhere, B-25, and he's flying to Washington, I take a ride with him and turn around and come back or whatever. Sometimes they pick up somebody from Nashville Field and fly them to Washington. Mm-hmm. And I get to hop. Cost me $10 for it. Parachute. Yeah.
Might
yeah.
need it.
Yeah.
Well, now, in the process of training all these people, most of them were trained as fighter pilots, P-47, right. P-51, mm-hmm. right? But they did train some for the B-25.
Oh, yeah. When they deactivated the 99th, I hear a phone ring. It's on, you know, what's it, John? Anyhow, when deactivated, they made it a 477 composite group, and that was made up of B-25.
Okay.
Before I go further here, you can turn that off if you want to.
Describe a typical day for you as a crew chief. What time would you get up? What would you normally do? How many hours would you work?
As a crew chief, I get up, go with breakfast at 7:30. I'll first take a shower, make my bed, gotta make that bed before you leave. Then I go out on the line, check my plane out, check the roster to see if I'm scheduled to supply my plane. If I'm not scheduled to supply my plane, I come back to the barracks, lay around a little bit, play a little card or something like that. If they call me, I'll go. But until then, or if they have another assignment, then I take it out of assignment. Other than that, I'm free.
So when your plane was going up, what did you do?
Well, I had to inspect it again.
Yep.
I pre-flight it, crank it up, take it around the block, bring it back, break, check my radio over the tower, back, park it, and check my Form 41B. It's ready to go.
How long would it normally take if you had a real problem, let's say an oil leak?
It depends on what kind of oil leak was.
Yeah. But if it was a pretty serious oil leak, would it take them a couple of days to fix it? Or
yeah, probably. probably according to what it was. Hardly ever, my plane, I've never had an engine change without it be assigned another plane.
Yeah.
Then they did.
So they'd take it out for a while.
Yeah.
So the mechanics then, the ones who were doing this work, whether they were changing tires or what,
in the shop,
were pretty good?
Oh, yeah. Well, they were pretty good. Oh, yeah. They had the shop, you know, and they'd take, come out and tow it in or whatever had to be done. They'd take care of it.
Now, in dealing with the process here, how did you interact with the people you were supervising? So you're going to be supervising somebody who's going to be changing the tires. You're the crew chief, right? Did that work pretty well? Did you get along with them all right?
I didn't even see them.
Oh, you would write out an order or something, and okay. So you didn't have to deal with them one-on-one.
If my radio was out, I got to hold of Earl Smith. He was in charge of the radio shack. I kind of tell him, I say, hey man, TU-17 is down, and the radio's not transmitting as it should, or whatever. Okay, so I'll take care of it. And he knew what my plane was. I said, it's spot 225 or whatever it is. He'd check it out, send somebody out for it, take it in, and that's it. Then when he's ready, he'll put up on the board that it's ready. So I had to check the board.
How long was the training for the pilots? Do you have any idea of how many weeks it took for them to go through the training?
I imagine it take about 9 or 13 months.
That long?
I'd say 6 to 13 months.
Because they'd have to learn navigation, they'd have to learn all of these other than just having to fly the plane.
Right, oh yeah.
Now normally, how long would it take them to move from one plane to another plane? If they would start with the trainer,
how long would they be? Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know that much. I don't know that technical area.
Yeah. But obviously, you would see them, they would spend a certain amount of time with that. Were you aware how many didn't make it, who dropped out? A lot, I know.
Oh, man, they washed out like mad. I think, I understand that the two lieutenants that were in charge of transit aircraft were washed out cadets. That's what I heard.
That's what they would do.
Yeah.
They would take the washed out cadets and put them back in another position.
Yeah, that's what I heard that these two fellows were. I didn't know, but I just heard that scuttlebutt.
Now, who was your direct supervisor? Was this a white officer
you had to report to? No, my direct supervisor as a crew chief?
Yeah.
Lieutenant Marshall.
Okay, and he was black?
He's black, yeah.
So you didn't have any specific contact with any of the white officers,
and
you probably wouldn't have had much to do with Colonel Parrish except here and there.
Salute him when I see him.
Yeah, well, that's always a good idea, salute the commandant.
You better.
Base. When you were thinking about these planes and the circumstances that they were getting ready to go into combat, I mean, that was the general idea, although, as you know, it took them a long time to finally approve them for combat. I mean, this training went on and on and on, and they were a little reluctant to put them into combat.
Right.
Was there a certain sense of frustration? I mean, you guys were working on the planes, they were training, and nobody was getting to fight?
Not with us. I didn't feel any. I think perhaps among the cadets and the other officers, but as far as the ground crew, I didn't feel any frustration. Mm-hmm. No, I didn't. The only frustration I saw was the bigotry.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah. Well, there were some people I've read about who were saying, well, look, this is our war too. We're American citizens.
Right.
This is our war. You know, we would like a chance to contribute. Mm-hmm. You're keeping us here on this base, and we're training, mm-hmm. and nobody's doing anything. Mm-hmm. This really is a little frustrating to go through the training without actually being allowed to go into combat. Did you hear much of that?
Oh yeah, I heard it, but I didn't allow that to control me.
Well, yeah, in your case it was a little different. You had your job to do.
That's all.
Yeah.
That's, you know, I thought about it. I said it's kind of a bad deal for those who volunteered to go.
Yeah.
See, so I'm a little on the edge. I didn't volunteer to go into this thing. I took it. It was a challenge for me to make good at the as to what was forced on me, but I didn't volunteer.
Well, but did you feel a sense of pride at all of being in the Army Air Corps and doing your job well?
I'm glad you said that, because I was speaking at a school, Childs Elementary School, mm-hmm. and a teacher had about 60 kids sitting in front of me, and a little black girl sitting over there, her hair hadn't been done in 3 weeks. She's dirty, and they had time to ask questions. And she asked me that question. She said, "May I ask a question?" She very proper, she stood erect. It surprised me because she looked like, you know, a cast off. And she said, "With all the achievement that you have acquired," this is what she said, 10 years old, "don't you feel proud of yourself? All glory, blah, blah." And she's talking to a 10-year-old girl. And she said, I said, "I'm glad you said that." I said, "My greatest pride."
End of tape A, side one. The interview continues on tape A, side two.
And what else did you say to that little girl?
I said, "Now, for me to, I told the little girl, I said, remember when I told you that in your families that maybe your brothers and sisters may not like you, and this, you might be a slow learner and all these things, and you could learn a trade and all this." This is fifth grade kids I'm talking to. And she said, "Don't you remember that?" And I said, "Remember that you, for me to come and tell you all these things, warms my heart. That's the joy I get. Not the achievement that the 99th and 332nd got. That's only an entrance fee for me to get here to talk to you." Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I would imagine that in particularly as we talked earlier about dealing with planes, you would have to have a lot of pride in making sure that plane was operating at full efficiency. Mm-hmm. I mean, not only you didn't want to kill anybody, but that was your job, and you wanted to do that job well because,
right.
you know, it's not like taking out the garbage.
Right.
You know, you might slop a few pieces here and there, but when you're fixing that airplane, if you mess up one thing,
the whole job is shot.
Yeah, so.
Well, it was as a pride of doing your job well. Bill Davis had said that we are in a conflict to prove something. And do the best you can, because black folk are known not to be able to cooperate with each other, because we're selfish and this, but we have to learn how to work together as a unit. And we do that, so this is what we always kept in our forefront. I'm doing the best I can with what I'm doing right now.
Because in essence, if the other people who worked failed, then the pilots would fail.
Right.
And the experiment would fail.
That's true.
So this is important for long term. Mm-hmm. I mean, because if this experiment fails, there might not be another one for quite a while.
Might not be one, period.
Yeah. Right. So were you conscious of that as you were going through this?
Not really. I didn't think on long term. I thought about what I had to do right now had to be perfect. I think about the future right then. This has got to be perfect, because I know if this is perfect, the future's going to be taken care of.
Did you keep up with the 99th and what they were doing and their exploits?
Well, while we were stationed there?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they kept us up. Because anytime they got a medal, we got medals too. Ribbon or something like that, whenever they had accomplishments over there. We got the same recognition as they did.
The other thing I was going to ask you, did they train pilots, they train mechanics, did they train navigators and bombardiers and all that?
Glad you said that. One thing, it was smart. Americans are smart. Now, what they did, they sent...
Not always.
Well, generally speaking.
Okay.
Generally speaking. What they did, they sent a bunch of us, I'm talking about blacks now, they sent a bunch of us to Shepherd Field, Texas. They sent a bunch to Chanute Field, that's up in out in Illinois, mm-hmm. and they learned radio. Then they sent some in Fort Hood, Texas, and they learned armament. Mm-hmm. And then and they brought all these fellows back together to main these planes. All of us are back together. That was pretty smart to do that with, I think, they had about 900 out of 900 men that went to Chippewa Field. I don't know how many graduated, but I think about 923 or something like that.
And of course, in combat, before you go into combat, the armament people got to come out and load up the 50 caliber machine guns. Mm-hmm. They got to do it right. They got to make sure that they've been oiled and they're working. You know, so everybody has that job. Somebody's got to load the bombs.
Right.
Some guys deal with the radio.
So what they did, they brought us all back to maintain these planes. So I'm the mechanic. So if something went wrong with so I didn't have to do it with armament. Mm-hmm. My job was just to make sure that radio was working. Mm-hmm. But those fellows overseas, they're the ones that had to work with the armament. See.
Yeah.
But they still sent fellows to Chanute Field to Fort Hood to learn armament. See.
Was there any chance that you were going to go overseas at all?
One time, it's funny, they gave us another AGCT test, and it took the top 40 and sent them to Harlingen, Texas, Harlingen Army Airfield, to go to school to learn to be belly gunners on B-25s. And I was one of the guys that went.
I don't believe I'd want that job.
Well, he said either the belly or the rear, you know, tail gun. Anyhow, I could have had a tear it in the 25 too. And they were going to train us, send us all down to Texas. We get down to Texas, and they put us way down at the end of the field in a little dirty barrack down there. And we stayed there for 3 weeks. But after we were there a week, we wondered whether we were going to start school. That colonel said, ain't no niggas going to school here. We had there's 40 of us, and we had one administrative sergeant travel with us. He called Washington to the adjutant general's office to find out what was wrong. We had a representative from Washington that came down. He queried the colonel who was in charge of that base and called us back into the mess hall, into the day room, and he said, I'm sorry, but we can't put you through school because I cannot override the commanding officer of this field. That's not in the picture.
No. Well, that's so short-sighted in the long run, isn't it?
And it's not public either. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not public knowledge. But I remember that. That was been the end of 44.
But they were trained elsewhere as bombardiers and radio operators and all that. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. That was probably after me.
Yeah, okay. When you followed the 99th, were you aware primarily of where they were or what they were doing when they were in North Africa or when they got to Europe?
Yeah, they queried us.
Yeah, and you were aware they were doing bombing raids and all that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. They queried us. In fact, they had a couple of officers came back and shared with us some of their experiences.
Well, and you know, I forget the exact number, but something like 66 were killed combat, and a certain number were captured, 30-some.
Right, POWs.
Yeah, they were POWs. Did you ever get a chance to talk to any of them, POWs, when they came back?
No, I didn't.
But you did talk to some who had been in combat?
Oh, yeah, some of the flyers.
Yeah.
Yeah, some of them came back, and they told us some of the things that took place over there.
What did they say about how they were used by the military? Once they had proven themselves, were they given assignments like everybody else?
Well, they couldn't get, well, a couple of them made it, like Chappie James and some others we don't hear about. Mm-hmm. But the ones that we talked to, they didn't get a chance. But some did filter through.
In other words, they'd been trained to fight, and they were over in a combat zone, and they wouldn't let them fly missions?
No, I mean, they let them fly. Maybe I don't follow you.
Well, I'm just wondering if they said, well, here we got some white pilots and the black pilots. Mm-hmm. Well, it's really important we bomb this railroad station. Let's put the good white pilots on that and let the black pilots come in later, or they can fly observation or whatever. I mean, did they discriminate in terms of assignments?
No, only one that I heard about was that they sent about 200 B-17s and B-24s to bomb Germany. And out of that, they lost 60. Mm-hmm. Lost the 60. And headquarters said, you ought to do something about this, y'all. We lose too many bombers. So somebody said, what about the black guys? Why give them a chance? That's when they got the opportunity.
Yeah.
And they proved it.
They proved it, yeah. Yeah.
Because so they lost it.
When we talk about the Tuskegee experiment, mm-hmm. if we take that as an example, why did it work? Because there were a lot of people who didn't want it to work, and there were a lot of obstacles to mm-hmm. overcome. Why in the end was it successful?
It was in God's plan. I'm a Christian. It's in God's plan that folks should be given, I believe, should be given equal opportunity. And because of that, hearts were moved in behalf of Mrs. Roosevelt and a whole lot of other white folks. You follow? A whole lot of them that we don't know about were on our side. Might have been some maid's husband. It worked in the kitchen, somebody. But you worked on their hearts and said, give these fellows a chance. That's all we need.
Were you aware? Well, part of it has to be perseverance, ability. I mean, not everybody, as you know, can fly a plane.
I agree.
Some of us can barely drive cars, leave alone fly planes. So it had to be commitment and perseverance and ability. I mean, those equations are part of the successful formula, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. But it's not just that you had an opportunity, mm-hmm. because people get opportunities all the time and fail.
Well, I believe with us who had the opportunity, it was a challenge. Mm-hmm. That was great. That's the greatest thing that took place, I believe, even if you weren't wholeheartedly at flying. You follow?
Yeah.
But here's a man telling me I'm stupid. I'm not going to accept that. I'm going to prove to him I'm not. So I believe it was made it successful. God's plan, working through people, and determination to prove that we are not stupid. That's the other half of it, I believe.
Were you aware of the Montford Point Marines, or are you aware of them now? Mm-mm. They were similar to the Tuskegee Airmen. They were African-American Marines trained separately, and mm-hmm. they were trained in combat, but when they went into combat, they had them load ammunition or supply.
I heard about that.
They were not allowed into combat, so mm-hmm. it's kind of interesting mm-hmm. that in the Air Force, the opportunity was there, but not in the Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes, as always, if you're in the Marine Corps, even if you're in supply, you have to fight, but by and large, they were put into what we would call menial positions, mm-hmm. although they were trained in combat.
Right.
So, well, let me go back and ask you a little bit something about you mentioned very briefly earlier. What did you think of the ceremony not too long ago when the Tuskegee Airmen were given the gold medal by President George Bush?
It's about time. 60 years, because this is back in, I was drafted in 1943. And I got out in 47. But that's a long time.
But you did not go to D.C., right?
Go where? No.
You didn't go to the White House?
No. I didn't go. I wasn't invited.
Oh, okay.
But see, the pilots were invited.
Just the pilots.
Just the pilots. See, they got the glory. The grease monkey didn't get any glory. That's Cliff Stern, right. He was the one that called me about that. Cliff Stern called me about it and said that down in Ocala, they're going to have a ceremony, and all those ground crew and those who are considered Tuskegee Airmen that worked with them, experienced, who was going to be given these medals. And he said that out of his Cliff Stearns Regents, there are only five of us. Only five. And Jim Lynch gave Cliff Stearns my name. He said, I know one here. Anyhow, so he gave my name.
Well, that'll be a nice occasion, won't it?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to take my wife.
Good. Well, I want to read you what Bush said, which I thought was pretty appropriate. He said, I would like to atone for all the unreturned salutes and unforgivable indignities. Then he saluted them.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, a little late, but better late than not.
Yeah, I saw it on TV. Yeah. That's on the salute.
Yeah. Well, I think people appreciate that, don't you?
Oh, I know. Sure they do.
Yeah. One of the problems that is true, and it's probably true in your experience, but more so the troops coming back from overseas. When African-American troops came back, it's been demonstrated more and more and more as time goes on that some of the German POWs lived better and were treated better than they were.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure you must have experienced that as people who've gone and fought for their country, they come back, and I've talked to many people in this category who said, we get on a troop train, they put us in the back. We didn't have a place to sleep. We didn't have anything to eat. We were all of a sudden back to being second-class citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And did you observe a lot of that?
Oh, yeah. Not only that, after I got out of the military, see, I've been a welder all my life. I learned how to weld in 1939. The last job I retired from, I was a welder. I was in charge of the welder. Anyhow, when I was at the shipyard that I had been deferred from, I went back to that shipyard for a job. You don't have a job. Huh? I say, hey, man, here's my discharge. Blah, 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 blah. Well, I'm sorry, we can't use it. So I went down to Baltimore and worked in, what's the name of that guy? Oh, slipped me again.
I would think that after war, it'd be a great demand for welders.
Oh, they had welders, but I couldn't, they didn't hire me.
Because you were a black welder.
Right, 1947. Well, Bethlehem Steel, that's where I worked.
Okay.
I was welding at Bethlehem Steel in Baltimore.
And that's one of the biggest steel companies at that time in the world, I guess. I've covered most of the things I needed to ask you, but I'm sure there are a lot of things that I haven't thought about that you'd like to discuss. What in particular would be important to you?
I thought that I had covered most of them.
When you were crew chief, were there many accidents?
Oh, yeah. Not too many, but a few.
and usually due to inexperienced pilots?
Well, they were just cadets.
Yeah.
Cadets, I think I remember one guy knows his plane, pull his stick back while it's still on the ground.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he had to take off. We could see it. Man, that's a beautiful AT-6. That thing was glistening. That guy had polished that plane. You see it glistening in the sunlight. He went down to the runway, man. That thing, yeep!
Didn't get too far.
He didn't get off the ground. Right into the ground. But I didn't see too many far. Too many. One guy died. Yeah, I saw about three. About three.
Now, in the beginning and throughout this, were they're advocates for not only the training of the pilots, but to put them in combat? Because I know that Thurgood Marshall and NAACP were at least agitating for the training.
Mm-hmm.
And were you aware that this was going on and that this was being pursued? It was never really taken to court, but they were making demands of the military. This is the United States military at war, and we're fighting for democracy in Europe, and our military is still segregated.
Mm-hmm. You know, I remember that.
That doesn't make a lot of sense, right? I mean, you can't be fighting for democracy in one place and denying it at home.
Mm-hmm. I think Thurgood Marshall and NAACP and all these other organizations helped push Ms. Roosevelt and others in that direction because they had realized that there were those of us who were interested in foregoing this thing. Because before they got in the Army Air Corps, They had their own private field anyhow, you know, mm-hmm. down at Moulton Field, I believe it was. That's they right. had they were training mm-hmm. Civilian. Mm-hmm. So they had some who had gained pilot license, because Anderson was one of them that was one of the trainers.
That's right. The early pilots were civilian pilots, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Some of the trainers were civilian pilots.
Yeah.
So when Mr. Roosevelt and the other people could see that they had qualified people already ready to go. See, but all they needed was a chance.
And in the end, what's the importance of the Tuskegee Airmen? Why should we know about them?
What should we know about them?
Yeah, why should we know about them? Why are the Tuskegee Airmen important?
I think they are important. They should be important more to the black folk to realize that there's a possibility of a unity among us. There's a possibility of a unity among us as black folk. Not to be segregated from white. No, I don't mean that now. I'm talking about as far as your self-worth is concerned. Mm-hmm. And when you put that to value, and this is a real example of what can take place if you put it to work.
There's a certain amount of black pride that comes out of this, collectively.
Not too proud.
No, but yeah. In a certain sense of achievement.
Right, now that's better. I like that one.
All right. When you were going through all of this, did you have any problems other than the white sheriff with the whites in these communities or around these communities? Were you ever threatened, or did you get any threatening phone calls, or did the Klan burn a cross or anything? Did you see any outside activity against Tuskegee and the training?
No. Only when I was in Montgomery, we got called a lot of names, you know, get on the
sure.
bus.
Sure.
And then get on the, of course you had to go sit in the back of the bus, even in uniform, you know, sit in the back of the bus. And they would say things, slurs and things like that toward you, but you pass it up.
Because it was a little difficult too, so you're in uniform, or you're at least in your service, and if you were to start a fight or get in any trouble down there, as you said before, they'd come and get you from Montgomery.
Oh yeah.
They would not be too happy with you, I wouldn't think. Plus, it could have undermine the experiment.
If it would have been anything.
Yeah, if there'd been some race riots or conflicts, I bet you they would cut it off, wouldn't they?
One time in Montgomery, a woman had a little baby on the back of the bus, and the baby was crying. Man, you heard it. I don't know whether it made news or not. The baby was crying, and the bus driver told that woman, said, quiet that baby down, and call all kind of names. I heard about it. I wasn't there. And they said that the bus driver got up and slapped the baby. And when he slapped the baby, a soldier was sitting in the back, and he cut the bus driver's throat on the way out of the bus.
Ooh. But see, it wouldn't take too many incidents like that to really...
That happened, and I was in Montgomery at that time.
I bet they hushed that up, don't you think?
Everybody hurts it up.
Yeah.
But we slept under the house. We didn't go in the house. We slept under the house. Oh man, that was something.
Well, in 1955, a lady didn't go to the back of the bus.
Oh yeah, about Curry Park. Yeah.
Sat down. It was interesting. That was Montgomery.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Because obviously that bus system was thoroughly segregated.
Oh yeah. Oh, Selma was something else, man. Oh.
Well, Birmingham was supposed to be one of the most blatantly racist cities in America.
My God, Birmingham?
Birmingham.
Now?
No, then.
I don't think so.
Really?
No, I think it was right here in Florida and in some parts of Georgia. At some point, and Alabama too as well, but I don't think Birmingham was worse. I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I don't think so. Those little towns down south.
Little towns, yeah.
Then when you
no place to hide, those little towns.
Then you, when you ride in your car, you tiptoe.
You don't want to break down, do you?
No, no, sir. You don't break down,
you don't want to have a taillight out.
You don't want no vinyl gas either. They take it quick. We don't have any gas.
Plus, they wouldn't serve you at any of the restaurants.
I know it. No. Some of them might serve you in the back.
Yeah, walk around the back.
Yeah. Hang yourself. I went one time. Since I've been out of military, I wanted to buy something to eat, and they took me around the back. And man, that place looked worse than a stall, man. I couldn't eat that food. Oh, man, took me around the back, and the drain was coming right down out the back. And the floor was wet. Oh,
you weren't that hungry.
Oh, man. I was hungry, but not like that.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about before we bring this to a close?
No, this is a privilege. I love speaking in schools, and the colonel and I have a ball. We go and he says, you know what, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be here for my group, you know. Because they really covered for us. They escorted us back and forth. When I saw those red tails, man, I felt good. He was colonel, something else, you know. He, whenever we get ready to go, so he calls me, you know. I'm getting ready to go. Can you go? I say, yeah, I'll go.
Well, that's good. See, these kids don't know anything about World War II.
I know.
It's like the Civil War is to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just so removed from their experience. So it's good for you to tell them about why we fought and what happened to you. I think
right.
That's important for the kids. Well, on that note, Mr. Lawrence, we'll end, and I want to thank you very much for your time.
All right.